When they used to launch a new book back in the old days, sometimes the poets would write a little poem to commemorate the occasion. And these poems would always start off, "Go, little book." Waller wrote one, Ezra Pound wrote one, and the book is thought of as something that flies, like I see it as launching a book is a little bit like being a falconer and launching a hunting bird off your hand. And usually in these poems, the book doesn't talk back, but I found that in my poem, it did. These poems are called an envoy, and my poem is called Envoy. "Go, little book, par avion. Wing versus torture targets, where faces cool and hardened behind bars, where an idea straps on a pistol, where the people eat their right to vote, where machine guns and TV cameras look from the tops of glass buildings. Go, little peregrine. Fly as I taught you, with bombs tucked under your wings in a V of attack, low to the ground, underneath the enemy's lazy radar. It's too much, though, isn't it, little friend? You glide over cool marble floors out into the womanly moonlight. A rose vine encircles you. You bleed on the thorns. Your throat opens to a harmony of seasons. You sing of the nest, of unruffled June mornings, of leaving the nest, of building it again, of its perfect circle. You would have me kill you, whose life is a breath? I pity you. Yes, I pity you. You warble and take off into the distance as if you thought you would live forever. I stand in the pre-dawn field, boots drenched, the big glove covering my wrist and hand, and watch you soar, a speck now, into the rainy future. There's a poet who writes in Persian. He's called Jalaluddin Rumi. And I wrote a poem that builds up to 8 lines by him. So it's a you'd kind of get into this. It's a I'm trying to shy away from the word spiritual, but it's kind of the beginning of a spiritual journey, I suppose you could say. And the poem is called 8 Lines by Jalaluddin Rumi. Leaving here, I slip out the gates of the palace garden as autumn stuns the trees with remembrance and makes them come around again, a memory of dervish flutes. In my mind, I hear the word perfect. My feet touch down into cool dust, and my eyes look up to the mountains that ring the high plateau. Perfect the way air is, including everything there is that one can pass through. The shadow wings of seabirds glide over storm clouds, forming and dissolving, turning to the unseen. And no one really knows what keeps one from going too. Sleeping under leaves, dissatisfied and hungry, praying to the great light by day and to the moon, Our Lady. My only friends were the wolves. A shadow fell from the old-fashioned porch light, called my name into the trees, and promised to buy me everything. I was held by the thought of return and went back far enough to hear the music that was once so much a part, but the cold wind blew it out of my heart. I crept unseen one rainy night into their carriage and caressed them in the likeness of warmth while they talked happily and drove. Yet the wind today spreads yellow leaves across the road, so familiar in the way it disappears over hills the color of sky, and the whirlwind dervish voices blow over desolate stone. Come, come again, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, it doesn't matter. Ours is not a caravan of despair. Come, even though you have broken your vows back there 1,000 times, come once more. Hotels are a wonderfully impersonal space. A hotel is a community, but it's a community that only exists for maybe one night, just the people who are there. And I've always been particularly intrigued by hotels. This one is set in Savannah, Georgia, and it's called Savannah Sleepless. A bell has rung 12 times. A bell has rung once. Twice. Could I be the last non-sleeper in Savannah? Elevators have been up, gathered, and then, with me in one, sent down again to where duels and steam locomotives hang on the bay's walls. Billiard balls stand expectantly in their round way. Two people begin to become musical. Powder puff, honey dark skin, pink gown with springy straps. She can kiss a passing cheek and keep singing. He tickles the ivories and looks like Nat King Cole. A machine plays the beat for their song. Two men discuss two women. Chairs are drawn up. Names are given. A notebook sits apart, entranced by the yin-yang of brandy and cigar. No, evidently, I am not the last waking human in the Hilton Hotel. The singer is explaining she doesn't want to set the world on fire. She just wants to start a flame in the heart of some unspecified you. Outside, the million tongues of the city sleep, and the blue Atlantic draws a breath. As was mentioned, I do these translations. My daughter, Julia, and I do these translations from a Turkish poet called Edip Cansever, and this is one. This is one that we've done from him. We call it Table. A man filled with the gladness of living put his keys on the table, put flowers in a copper bowl there. He put his eggs and milk on the table. He put there the light that came in through the window, sound of a bicycle, sound of a spinning wheel, the softness of bread and weather. He put there. On the table, the man put things that happened in his mind. What he wanted to do in life, he put that there. Those he loved, those he didn't love. The man put them on the table too. 3 times 3 make 9. The man put 9 on the table. He was next to the window, next to the sky. He reached out and placed on the table endlessness. So many days he had wanted to drink a beer. He put on the table the pouring of that beer. He placed there his sleep and his wakefulness, his hunger and his fullness. He placed there. Now that's what I call a table. It didn't complain at all about the load. It wobbled once or twice, then stood firm. The man kept piling things on. This is a poem about a train trip, and it has a date with it, 1945, because it's about the it's about the end of a particular war, and it describes a train trip from. Well, it used to be you could take a train. Well, you still can, in fact. Only it used to be a much better train. It was called the Crescent City. And you could get on the train in the country where I'm from, the United States. You could get on the train in Boston, and you could take it all the way down to New York through Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, through the Deep South, and go all the way to New Orleans. And that's where the men in this poem are going on this trip. The thing is, they're soldiers who've just been discharged from the army, so they're on their way home. It's called Southbound Pullman, 1945. Discharge papers in duffel bags. Their train thumps half speed out of Boston. Sunset kindles the coky haze over Back Bay Station. Bricky courtyards, windswept corners, and clotheslines, a view of someone's kitchen. A victory garden with fists of cabbage. Then the lights switch on. A boy and his father burning leaves. Obscured by dusk on a patch of green, wave up at faces starred in the southbounds, passing constellation. Stewards uncork bottles, ice clinks in the club car. A new deck crackles, Atlantic sea salt blows in, and a whiff of coal smoke. Steam builds, the whistle finds its pitch and sounds an airy, unstopped note over darkling marshes and shore towns shutting down for the night. Dinner is gonged through aisles of opened collars and bourbon. The galley vents coffee scald and steak sizzle down the Connecticut Valley. Penn Station at midnight, bustle of red caps, morning editions, hot Java, train men tuning the wheels with big wrenches, then distances again. Porterly hands tuck ironed cotton and turn drowsy blankets back. Darkness cradles the swaying coaches over strumming track. Snoring, then a nightmare scream jangles to its feet the whole sleeper. Home voices murmur, "You're okay, son. The war's over, soldier." All night, the breathing of plowed fields, the continent opens like a hand. Tomorrow, bands and a convertible. Then fresh mistakes begin. When we're first learning about poetry, they make a big point of the differences between fiction and poetry, how these are two separate areas. But maybe actually fiction and poetry have quite a lot in common with each other, because I think oftentimes in poetry people fictionalize, and also one thing that I found myself doing quite a bit of in writing poetry is creating characters, but on a not on a large scale as someone would do in a novel, but sort of a poem is about a particular character. And I heard somebody say something about writing poetry one time that's always made a lot of sense to me. And they said that there are two very strong human impulses that affect people who put pen to paper. One is to reveal, and the other is to conceal. I think there's a lot of truth in that. And so, in a way, you want to, if you write, you want to, tell your story. On the other hand, you want it to be your story. You may be telling the truth, but you want to lie, and you want to just to slant it. And I think that's maybe what fictionalizing is all about. So I thought I would read you. I have three more poems here that I would like to read, and each one of these kind of does a character. And the first one, this one is set somewhere in Ireland, and it's called His Days. When one of his black moods bedeviled him, when the wince of some remembered pain, some wrong done to him, some cruelty of his own, hurt him like a surge melting down bad wiring, what choice was left him but to flinch and swallow and bear it like a man? The cottage's slates and silences became his kingdom, its weathers his own. He would coax to a blaze coal and turfs each morning, and chunks of beech he split with his own axe. The farmer's son or Sunday hikers would see him hunched at his kitchen table, away in his books. Then obscurely one morning he'd lock his cottage door. With a word to no one, he'd be gone to look at an old church somewhere, or the ruin of a tower down a dirt track, or a stone incised with markings no one could decipher, its language crumbling by degrees in the rain. He could navigate the old script, and he knew why an arch was rounded or Gothic, why the mermaid held a mirror, which sins the monks allowed themselves and which they disavowed. He knew the Greece of the high kings belonged to the church of bitterness, had bet on the cards of pride. But when on some grimy market town's main street he heard a child, eyes widening in wonder, call out Daddy, reaching for his father, or a couple taking snaps of each other, then it seemed the pain was complete. The water was wide, and he could not swim over. I like coming to Cork. I like being on the water, and I like looking at the river. And one of the thoughts that comes to mind about being in Cork is the country where I grew up. And many people's experience was formed by immigrating there from somewhere else, and many of them from here. And many, many people who ended up in America would have sailed out of Cove. I just learned the other night that Frank and Jesse James's parents were from Kerry. For example, they wouldn't be the only example of Irishman who had done well in the next parish, but they would be one. And well, I once heard a paper by a woman who teaches at the university here. Her name is Grace Neville. And she did a paper, I think she's in the French department. She did a paper on immigration. And it really blew my mind and opened up a lot of things about the process of immigration that I hadn't really thought about before. And what she said was, it wasn't so much that people would be moving from one country or one culture to another, but really they would be moving from one world to another. It was a totally different reality. Those words sound very pale if you say moving from one reality to another, but if we take it more literally and think what really moving from one reality to another reality, I mean that's some pretty heavy stuff. And she talked about some of the customs that were that surrounded immigration. One that appealed to me very greatly was that sometimes when people would be leaving their farm, they would walk around and they would carve their name into the handle of a spade, or they would carve a word onto a fence post or something like that, knowing that that no one would discover it. Maybe it'd be a couple of months after they were gone, then someone would see that little that word. It was kind of a message, and of course, for many of these people, particularly from the west of Ireland, they would be moving from an environment where the primary language was Irish to all of a sudden they would be in a place where they would have to speak English. I'm telling you too many things about this poem, but you can see it's a pretty it's not a simple subject. And and you know the American wake that everyone talks about. Well, one of the things that she said in her paper was one of the things about the American wake is that it might be a few days before the man would even be conscious. You know, they'd put him on board ship, and then he would come out of that haze, and there he would be in the middle of the Atlantic. So, pardon the long introduction. This is called The Immigrant. Two places only there were, here and America, the four corners of the farm and gone beyond the sea. With a tuppenny nail, he etched into the iron shank of his spade the word destiny. Drove it with his boot smartly into the earth and left it standing. Abroad commenced at the town line. The new world blinded him on the Navan Road. And again, the first time he tried to speak English. And again, the first time he saw an orange. Anesthetized by reels and barrels of porter and eight renditions of the parting glass, he fell asleep to the groan of oars, and awoke to a diesel thrust and sleet over mountainous seas. And I'll just mention that I've just recently published this book, Selected Poems from Daedalus. I brought five copies, and I would be very happy to sell you one for, they cost 15 euro. And my last poem for you tonight, and thank you very much for listening to these poems. I didn't particularly feel like giving kind of a pub reading, if you know what I mean. I just really wasn't in the mood. I was more, still am in a more kind of interior mood, if I may use that word. So pardon me if I didn't give you a lot of sort of pub reading type poem, if you know what I mean. Here's one called We Kept Missing Each Other. This is my last point. It's this sort of fictional thing that I was talking about. And, you know, two guys, let's say, their lives kind of don't quite meet up with each other, but they're sort of near misses. I mean, you know, these sort of two life paths that, well, they keep missing each other. And I'll just mention that I don't think there are many people who are here as old as I am, but when I was a boy in Memphis, Tennessee, I used to read the newspaper, and I would read about something called Cafe Society. I don't think they talk about that much anymore, but you know how it is when you're a kid, when you're first kind of finding out about the world, and finding out about it through a newspaper. You see these pictures, and there was this thing called Cafe Society, and it always, I thought, well, what could that be? And it always was the same kind of thing. There would be a bunch of people sitting around a table. There would be an incredible number of bottles and glasses and ashtrays on it. And Frank Sinatra was generally sitting at this table, and Ava Gardner. And then there was kind of a swarthy-looking chap called was called Porfirio Rubirosa. And I don't know if you've ever, anyone here else here has ever heard of him, but he was what they used to call a Latin lover, and they don't use that term anymore. But whatever it was about Porfirio, the girls really liked him, and I would refer to him in this point. We kept missing each other. Those days, I anchored the far end of the bar at the Black Mariah, spilling drinks and beating the jukebox with lugubrious quarters. You'd be halfway up Mount Analog, hooded in that weird white caftan of yours, sitting in the lotus, mumbling your incomprehensible mantra, inhaling moonlight up the business end of your kundalini. But when I tried to join you, belaying up a rubble-choked crevasse, my knuckles bleeding, one knee out of whack, I found the hut empty, your devotional candle still a smolder. Years later, I heard you had something going on Wall Street. We're getting pretty good at puts and takes. Now, myself, I was always shy around girls. You had, if anything, too many of them. A thirst for loving shook him like a snake, they quoted. Porfirio Rubirosa, just didn't measure up, they said. The word Fred Astaire was mentioned. We kept missing each other. I was living on a commune in Venezuela, shrimp fishing off a houseboat, drift fishing for sharks. You were cultivating the perfect lawn. Your garage was in perfect order. The wax job on your Buick was dazzling. I paid off my debts, got a job writing for the Wall Street Journal. My rental properties were just starting to pay off. That's when I found you working as a shade tree mechanic outside Yuma, Arizona. Brought you a six-pack of Pabst Blue Ribbon while you rebuilt a Volkswagen engine on a riverbank under cottonwoods. I felt most at ease in a hotel. Liked putting my belongings into impersonal drawers. You were spending most of your time at home by this point, smoking your pipe by the fire, looking Victorian. A paterfamilias surrounded by the next generation. And just to think that Richard was your name, too.